Trials and Sanctification in James was presented by Ron Julian on July 30, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, good morning. We're going to do things a little differently this morning, actually a lot differently. I want to start out by, every now and again it's appropriate for the person up front to tell a sad story and evoke great pity in the audience. And this is my moment. It's not very sad and it's not very pitiful, so it's going to flop, but I'm going to try anyway. The good part of this is that I was asked some time ago to write an article for the Southern Baptist Journal of Theology. The bad part of this story is that journal article is due Tuesday. And I have been working on it very hard for the last couple of weeks. And this is my way of saying I've been working on it very hard the last couple of weeks, as in not doing anything, looking in the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians, which is what we're talking about here. I finally decided the only way I was going to have anything to talk about this morning is if I basically tell you what I wrote in this article. So that's what I'm going to do this morning, is take you through roughly what it is I talked about in this article. I just have to say on a personal note that writing this has been a real struggle for me. I mean, everybody has their little things in life that are difficult. I have the kind of strange situation that every now and again I can write something that turns out okay. To my mind, that's something kind of like a curse, because I hate writing. Writing is very, very difficult. And I can't describe to you what it is that happens. I mean, I know I'm weeks away, I'm months away from this article being due, and I sit down and I start trying to put it together, and I just cannot make it work. I cannot get my mind engaged. I'm sitting there, I start writing something, and no, that's not going to work, and I try to write something else, and that won't work, and I try to put an outline together, and I say, well, but there are all of these decisions to make. There are these hundreds of decisions to make about how you're going to do this, and I can't make any of them. It's like I'm stuck. I just get stuck in this loop. And what happens is you come to the spot like now when the pressure is really on because it's due in 2 days. And it's like the agony of that pressure forces you to do it. It's like I write something bad because I have to write something. And that kind of forces me. I can write something bad, and then I can go back and look it over and say, okay, well, maybe I can fix this up, and eventually I can work myself to something that works. But I just can't do it on a schedule. I just can't say I'm going to start writing this now so I have plenty of time. I've been trying that my entire life, and it never works. So I'm in the middle of the agonies of trying to get this paper done, and I'm going to try here this morning to... I don't know how this is going to work. I can't read you the paper because it's too technical and it would bore you to death. And I haven't exactly turned it into a talk or anything. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it, and every now and again something will occur to me to say to you. That's kind of what's going to happen this morning. So I appreciate your patience with me. Hopefully we'll have something worth talking about when this is all done. The topic that I was asked to write on for this paper is the topic of trials and sanctification in the book of James. And that's what I have been trying to write about. You may remember that James starts out with one of the most straightforward and challenging statements about trials that you find in the Bible. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. And I imagine that many Christians have wrestled with, I certainly did, can he really mean that? Is that just some sort of religious hyperbole? I mean, some sort of exaggeration. I'm supposed to rejoice in trials? That must be Christian talk for put up with and don't gripe too long and too loud, because that's the best that you could expect out of a trial, right? I mean, it would seem that joy would be an appropriate response only if the outcome of a situation were highly desirable. You rejoice in something that's highly desirable. But that, in fact, I think is the key. That's what James is arguing in his book, is that the result, the outcome of trials is highly desirable. Not that trials themselves are fun to go through, but that the outcome is highly desirable. And what is that outcome that's desirable? Well, I think, in essence, what James is saying is that the outcome of the trials of our faith is our sanctification. And that is the desirable outcome that he's talking about. And I want to be clear, I go into some detail in the paper. It is not that the word sanctification or the Greek word behind that is actually used in the book of James. It isn't. But if you'll just grant me that we're talking about something like the growth of a believer into Christian maturity, then that's the theme in James, and in particular, the connection between the testing of our faith and the maturing of our faith. That's the theme that James discusses. At the beginning of the paper, I won't go into a lot of detail here about this, but if you were aware, if you had done any reading in the myriads of commentaries on the book of James, you would find that a number of them treat the book of James as if it were, in essence, something like the New Testament book of Proverbs. And that's a very important decision to make, because usually when we go to read a book, certainly if I were to read one of Paul's letters, I would go into it assuming that Paul has a particular situation in mind that his readers are involved with, and that he has a coherent flow of thought in his letter. And I would argue that trying to understand what is the situation that he's writing to and what is the coherent flow of thought that puts that all together, that is crucial. We cannot claim to have understood a particular book of the Bible unless we have understood the coherence, how it all fits together. So if we're going to come along and say, in essence, in James, even though it sounds like a letter, it's not really a letter, it's not written into any particular situation, and it doesn't have any coherence, it's just a series of disconnected statements about wisdom and basically like the book of Proverbs, then we're going to approach the book in one particular way. And one of the things that I have to do is sort of defend out in this academic world where that tends to be the approach that is taken to the book, I at least have to make this passing nod and apology that that's not the way I'm doing this. I don't think that's not the sort of book that James is. James is a book that is written to a number of churches with a general knowledge of the kinds of situations that those churches are facing. It's not like the book of Corinthians that is written to one church that Paul lived with for a year and a half. It is written to a number of people that James probably doesn't know very many of. He knows some of them, but probably most of the people in those churches he is not personally acquainted with. But he knows what's happening out there. He knows the kinds of challenges that people are facing, and he's writing into those challenges. So part of what I've tried to do in studying the book of James is come to understand what is the coherent picture that James has. After my academic apology, we start looking at, consider it all joy, my brethren, whenever you encounter various trials, knowing that the proving of your faith brings about perseverance. James does not share our culture's sort of vague concept of faith as a vague belief that things are going to be okay. When James talks about faith here and the proving of faith, the testing of our faith, For him, faith has a particular content. It is a set of ideas that have implications that we must face into. If we were to sort of wander through the book and try to put together what is faith for James, I would say the human soul is in peril of death. It is in peril of facing the adverse judgment of God and needs to be saved. That's one of the truths that encompasses, that makes up our faith. Such salvation is available from God. God will justify and be gracious to the one who responds to God. In contrast to the judgment which awaits the unredeemed, those who come under God's grace stand to inherit the crown of life and a place in God's kingdom at the return of the Lord. This inheritance is valuable beyond measure. Therefore, even though believers may suffer much in this life, their future hope makes them rich and exalted. Now, I would say that that, in essence, is the content of the faith that James is talking about. Certainly, it starts with the idea that Jesus is the Christ, but it has much more specific content than that. Jesus is the king of a particular kingdom where the fulfillment of human life is to be found. And being a citizen in that kingdom makes you rich and exalted, even though your life in this world may be poor and difficult. Now, if this is in fact the faith that James is talking about, then there are a couple of implications to that. If that is the faith, and what he describes as the faith is true, if this is really the way things are, then the most important events of my life are still ahead of me at the end of the age. They are invisible to me now. The most significant events of my life, the most significant aspect of my life, the thing that is most noteworthy about my existence is out there still waiting to be grasped, unseen. However, the second point is, today is the day that I have to choose. Today is the day that I have to decide whether in fact that's true, whether in fact those riches really are mine, whether in fact that kingdom is there and tangible and ready to be inherited. That's the tension. The thing that gives the significance and purpose to my life is out there where I can't quite get at it yet. And yet today is the day that I have to decide whether or not it's true. Therefore, by its very nature, if that is what faith is, and that's the implications of having faith, then that kind of faith is going to be tested by the circumstances of our life. We're going to be forced to decide today whether those intangible truths are substantial enough to affect how we live today. And we talk about this a lot around here. But is it true or not? It makes a lot of difference. I'm an idiot to invest my life in wealth that is no wealth, that doesn't even exist. It is not going to bring me blessing. It is not going to give me eternal life. It is not going to be the fulfillment of my existence as a human being. It's just a myth. It's just a story. I'm an idiot to have invested my life in that if it's not true. But I'm an idiot to pass it by if it is true. It makes all the difference. And so whether I believe it or not, that issue is going to be sorted out for me in this life. And that's why James says that we encounter trials, I think that's a good way of translating it. This word sometimes is translated temptations. I think probably for James' purposes here, our English word trials captures it better. The idea is those kinds of circumstances that try us, that test what we're made of, those sort of circumstances that bring out what is real about us, what is true about us. And then the other word he uses, knowing that the, I translated it here, the proving of your faith. This word has its emphasis on the idea of something that has been tested and proven. Proof, approvedness, proving. So, it is the process of testing our faith and demonstrating it to be real. That's what he's talking about. That is the thing that produces what he calls perseverance. So, James has this concept. I'm passing by a number of technical details here, but James has this concept that faith is this rich set of beliefs about the need for salvation and the inheritance of the redeemed, and that set of beliefs is put to the proof in the midst of trials. Now, what does that look like? What sort of thing are we talking about? Let me say a couple of things about that. I want to expand out here now, away from the particular verses at the beginning, and kind of step back and look at the book of James as a whole. What is his picture of how faith gets tested? Okay, first of all, the book of James as a whole, I think, is written from the perspective that there are big problems out in the churches to which James is writing. Listen to some of the phrases that he uses. Do not be deceived. Be doers and not just hearers who delude themselves. If anyone thinks himself to be religious, and something is true, his religion is worthless. There are quarrels and conflicts among you. You adulteresses, you double-minded. This is not a letter written into a situation where James is just saying, well, you know, I'm sure everything's fine out there, but let me just send you all a note of encouragement. James is worried about the situation that he is aware of out in the churches. In particular, the concern that he has, the issue that people are facing, one of the big ones seems to be the question of wealth. What do I think about money? One of the examples we see in the letter is, what happens if a rich person comes into the assembly, comes into the synagogue? We're talking about a fairly early state of things here. I mean, we're basically talking about Jewish Christians coming together in a very similar way that they would have in the synagogues, and a wealthy person comes in among them. What do you do? And James is afraid that what he sees happening is, when a wealthy person comes in, everybody sort of bows and scrapes and, oh, we're so happy to have you here. Here, come and sit over here. This is a really good seat up front. You'll be able to see everything real well here. But if somebody poor and insignificant comes in, you basically say, oh, yeah, you go sit back there. I mean, there was a certain honor or lack of honor to where people sat. In our situation, we would make the poor person sit in the front row. So, what's behind that? Why do people do that? Why do we do that? Why were they doing that? Well, I mean, it's fairly obvious, I think. Wealthy people have prestige. They have significance, and they have money. I feel ennobled by being recognized and treated with respect by somebody who has a lot of status in my society. And that person stands in a good position to do me well. I mean, just think about it, okay? I mean, in our little church here, Bill Gates becomes a Christian, joins our church, and decides to start tithing. You going to tell me that that doesn't catch the attention of anybody here? I mean, this is, Once in my life, I have had the experience early in the days, I've told this story before, but early in the days of my involvement with the study center, we were given a donation from someone who was, by my way of thinking, fabulously wealthy. I mean, he was the heir of a great fortune and had, you know, just the interest that came to him every year was multiple millions of dollars. I mean, this is a very wealthy person. And he had a foundation, and he donated money to the study center, which was very much appreciated. He came to visit the study center to kind of see, to check it out. What is this place and what's going on here? And I can remember feeling very, very ill at ease and nonplussed. How exactly am I supposed to behave here? I want to treat him as if it doesn't make any difference that he has all this money and is thinking about giving some to us. I want to treat him as if that's not true. And yet it is true. And, you know, I found myself, he probably went away thinking, that is the rudest person I ever met in my life, because you're sort of, you know, bending over backwards not to seem like you're trying to butter him up. So, you know, kind of ignore him and, you know, oh yeah, what? I mean, it was very difficult. I found it a very difficult, challenging situation. And God recognized my difficulty and has never sent any wealthy people in my path since. So, but that kind of situation forces you to think about, what do I believe? What do I value? If I'm going to treat somebody who in my culture has no status and can't really give me much in terms of, you can't increase my position in the society, you can't give me money. I mean, there isn't anything in this world that you're really offering me that is going to increase my chance of living well. If that's the way I think about you, then what has happened to this claim that I believe the gospel? The gospel which tells me that the poor believer is rich because the poor believer is an heir of the kingdom of God, that kingdom that God has promised to those who love him. Every person that loves God is rich, no matter what they have in this world, because what they have, they will not lose. And the picture that James paints is one of the rich ending up losing everything that they have, and those who seem to have so little now being exalted and raised up and gaining in the end everything. That's what our faith tells us. So, dealing with the question of the rich, especially in their society, where the rich had even more influence and even more power either to help or to harm, and the rich were doing a great deal of harm to many of the believers in this situation, how I think about them is a great test of my faith. Who is it that I really think is rich? The one who seems to have everything now, or the one to whom God has made the promise, you stand to inherit everything in the end? So that's the issue they're facing. If that's true, then I think it helps us to see that trials are more than just hardships. As we think of the trials and the testing of our faith, we're not just talking about difficult things. We're not just talking about, you know, oh, I had a flat tire, or oh, I got sick, or something like that. Those are difficult things. But they may not actually be all that much a trial of our faith. I can get sick, just put up with it, move along, and not hardly even think about the issues of my faith. I mean, that can happen. And then I can be afflicted with having to write a paper, and I'm down on my knees crying out to the heavens, why have you forsaken me? I mean, it all depends. Everybody's challenge is different. But the trials that we're talking about here, the rich are a trial to the believers that we're describing here just by showing up in their assembly. It's not that they're coming into the assembly and beating up on them. They're just coming. But their being there is a trial. It is forcing the believers to deal with the question, what do I value in this life? That's what James is picturing as a trial. That's what he's getting at. The testing of our faith is anything that forces me to confront the question, what do I really believe? What James says is, the process of proving our faith, of testing and showing its genuineness, results in what he describes as perseverance. Perseverance is a big theme. Perseverance is, in essence, the favorable outcome of the trial. I hold on. I persevere in my faith. Later on, he says, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, for having been approved, he will receive the crown of life. James, in essence, sees perseverance as the way in which our faith is proven. The fact that we persevere, the fact that we hold on to the faith in the midst of the trials of life. But here's where, again, if we look out at the overall picture in James, we can see that we're not just talking about continuing to be a Christian. Perseverance does not mean I am a Christian for a long time. Because one of the striking things about this book is that James is not writing to a group of people where he fears that they are going to stop being Christians. Some of Paul's letters, and say the book of Hebrews, that book is written to people who look as if they're about to walk away from the gospel itself. They're looking at it and they're saying, I don't think this is true anymore. I think something else is true. I don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Or I do believe that he's the Messiah, but I think it's a different kind of Messiah than what you said, Paul. Something else. That's not what's happening here. These are people who are all, they're going to the assembly, they believe in Jesus. I mean, the problem is not that they are embracing a new religion. The problem is that they are not embracing the implications of the religion that they have. They believe in Jesus, but they refuse to acknowledge what that means to their life. So, perseverance, then, as James is picturing it, means when, in the midst of my life, I face into the issues of my faith. Is God real? Is God good? Can I count on Him? Do I really want the kingdom that He is promising? As life forces me to face those issues, in the midst of those questions, I persevere. I may, in becoming a Christian, say, okay, I believe that Jesus rose from the dead and that he's the Christ. And I may mean it. Somewhere down the line, life may force me to recognize, oh, wait a minute, that means something. It means that I'm a sinner, say, and I need God's mercy. I may face into, for the first time, that I have to admit that there is something wrong with me. There are all sorts of ways in which the beliefs of our faith get tested. Persevering means to continue to believe all that the gospel teaches when embracing those truths and the implications of those truths gets tough. It's easy to believe in some kingdom somewhere, but when my comfort is on the line and you tell me you have to decide, is the God who has made you uncomfortable worth following because he has promised you the fulfillment of your existence? Now, I really have to get in and ask myself whether what I have been saying is true to me. Is this really me? Is this my life? Is this what I want? So, that's the picture that James has. The testing of our faith, the proving of our faith, results in perseverance. Continuing to embrace the faith, even when it has been made clear to me what's at stake. He goes on to say, perseverance is to have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. At this point, I translate this, perseverance is to have a fully developed work, which is a, I don't defend it as a good translation. I think of it as the least unsatisfactory translation I can come up with at this point. The idea here, the word that he uses, teleos, which we often translate as perfect, is sometimes translated as mature. And the idea is, this is a familiar idea to many of you, but an adult is a perfect child, is a teleos child. That is, it is a child who has grown up and become what a child is supposed to grow into. An oak is a teleos acorn. The acorn is intended to grow up into the oak. When it has grown up into the oak, then it has arrived at the goal. It has matured. It has become what it's supposed to be. That's the sort of word that this is. And what James is saying is that this process of testing our faith and hanging in there in the midst of the testing of our faith is intended to have this result of maturing, completing, fully developing our faith. He says this a little later on in James when he talks about the testing of Abraham's faith. Abraham, you remember, was asked to offer up Isaac. God had promised to Abraham, Isaac is the child of promise. Isaac is the one through whom your descendants will be named. Isaac is the one who will fulfill the promises that I have made to you. And then at a certain point, God comes to Abraham and says, I want you to give him back. I want you to take him up on the mountain and offer him to me. Which in essence is saying to him, I want you to give him back. That was a test of Abraham's faith. In that situation, Abraham had to decide, I would argue what was happening there, is that Abraham had to decide, is God faithful to his promises or not? He said that this child, Isaac, would be the one through whom his promises would be fulfilled. So, and now he's asking me to give him back. Okay, I'll do what he asked me because I trust him. But as Hebrews says, Abraham was thinking in his head, God must be going to raise him from the dead. Because this is the child that he promised would be the fulfillment of the promises he made to me. So I know that Isaac must live. Meanwhile, I'm going to obey God. Well, what James says about that is that faith was working together with what Abraham did in offering up Isaac. And as a result of what he did, as a result of his works, faith was perfected. And this word, the verb here of this word was used. Abraham had a genuine faith. He really believed the promises of God. But when he had to act on those promises and actually choose to trust God in a very real and difficult situation, his faith was perfected. It was matured. It was completed. Faith has become what faith is supposed to be when we have actually lived it out, when we have actually faced into the questions, what does this mean to me, and made choices as a result of them. When we have actually matured, when we have actually seen the implications of what we believe and acted on those implications, that is a faith that has grown up. That is a faith that has become perfect. James goes on to say, but if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. We're going to run out of time for me to explain everything that we're dealing with here, but you have to picture this. Perseverance is to have a perfect, a fully developed work, that you may be fully developed and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. It's crucially important, I believe, to see the connection that James is making here. He's saying to a group that he is writing a very stern letter to in many ways, that what's supposed to be happening is their faith is being tested, they persevere in the midst of it, and their faith is matured. Their faith is strengthened, and their understanding grows, their commitment to the faith grows. There is this maturity that results through the process of having your faith tested. But the fact is, as we can see throughout the rest of the letter, that James doesn't see this happening in many of the people that he's writing to. That's not what's been going on. So what's supposed to be happening is a maturity of faith is supposed to be resulting, but it isn't there for many of them. And so he says, what's supposed to be happening is that you would be lacking in nothing. That is, your faith would have matured into everything that a faith ought to be. But if any of you lacks wisdom, what does James mean by wisdom? He means what he has been talking about, this maturity, this mature faith that results through the process of trials. We can see that if we go later in the book. Later in the book, James talks about how not many of them ought to be teachers. And why not? Because of the wickedness of the tongue. You want to know the kind of awful stuff that comes out of people's mouths? That's why not many of you should be teachers. You want to know who is wise and understanding? You want to know who ought to be teaching, who ought to be saying something? Well, look around. Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the humility of wisdom. That's the person who's wise. The person whose life shows this humility that characterizes wisdom. The wisdom from above, he says, is first pure, then peaceable, humble, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering and without hypocrisy. That's wisdom. It is a person who has seen the truth, who understands what life is about, truly, because they have seen the reality of the things that the faith teaches, and they have embraced them, and they're living them out. The one who is wise is the one whose life shows the mark of it. It's not somebody who trumpets themselves as being really smart, or you ought to listen to me. It is someone whose life shows the mark of their faith. That's the kind of wisdom that James is saying they ought to be looking for. If somebody's going to tell you they're wise and they ought to be standing up in front of you, then check them out. Is there any mark that this stuff has actually gotten a hold of them? So, this process is supposed to bring about this maturity, but if any of you lacks wisdom, if the fact is that you are not perfect and complete, lacking in nothing, but you lack, you are not wise, you are not mature the way I have been describing. One of the mistakes that we make with this verse, I think, is to see James as making a promise here of divine guidance. If anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and God will give it to him. And we interpret that as, if anyone wants to know what to do, gee, I'm not sure in this situation what to do, but if I ask God and I really believe, then he'll tell me what to do. That's not what James is saying here. Wisdom in James does not mean knowing what to do. I don't know whether to go to this college or this college, and so God tells me. That's not wisdom. Wisdom is the fruit of a mature belief in the gospel. Wisdom is understanding who is valuable in this world, seeing my connection with the poor believer instead of valuing the rich man. Wisdom is not fighting and clawing and scratching to get the stuff of this world away from you, but living with you in peace because I believe that God has my welfare firmly in his hands. That's wisdom in James. If you're lacking it, then ask of God and he will give it. Now, I'm running out of time, so I want to jump ahead. There are a lot of things to talk about in this section. I want to conclude with what James says about, in verse 12, "Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which he has promised to those who love him." Who is it that is truly blessed? Who is it that is truly fortunate? Who is the one who is truly to be envied? This is a question that the Bible addresses a lot. The prophets raise that question. The wisdom literature raises that question. Jesus raises that question. James here is answering that question, probably the key statement in the book of James. Who is blessed? Not the rich. It is not the rich man in this world who is blessed. It is the one who perseveres under trial. That is the one who is blessed. And why is he blessed? Because the crown of life, the crown which is eternal life, awaits him. The one who loves God will receive the crown of life. And how do you know the one who loves God in this world? It's the one who perseveres when his faith is tested. That's the one who loves God. And so he stands to inherit. Now, there are a couple of implications that I want to bring out from this idea in James. This is a lot. This is a very, very meaty section in James, and there's an awful lot to talk about. But a couple of things I really want to bring out. First of all, I think this really gives us some insight into the nature of sanctification. And here's what I mean. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but if you were to sort of look over through the centuries the various teachings that the church has had about sanctification, and there are all kinds of them, there are a number of them that have always seemed to me to be kind of incoherent. I mean, the picture, it's kind of like this. If I come to you and I say, if you stand on your head, I'll give you a dollar. I said, okay. I could have said, if you climb up on the roof, I'll give you a piece of lemon pie. I could have said, if you wash the dishes, I won't spank your bottom. I mean, you know, talking to it. I mean, there are varying levels of relationship between what it is you did and what it is you got. Some of the teaching about sanctification has that sort of arbitrary sort of quality. God says to me, if you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, then I will stick some you climb to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. I will see to it that you have your name said three times on The Tonight Show by Jay Leno. I mean, so what? I mean, what are we talking about? I mean, it's kind of silly the way I'm describing it, but sometimes the teaching on sanctification that I've heard kind of sounds like that, as if they're these sort of separate things. I do this seemingly arbitrary thing of believing in Jesus, and God does this seemingly arbitrary thing of giving me this power to be good. But that's not the picture that James paints. The connection between sanctification and faith in James is there. You can't hardly even separate them. The expression two sides of the same coin is very appropriate. Because what James is picturing is, look, faith is a set of real beliefs about the way things are in the world. If I believe that the water in Eugene is toxic, then I stop drinking it. And if I don't stop drinking it, you might have the right to ask, okay, either you don't want to live, or you don't really believe it, even though you say you do. the reality of the Christian faith, the faith tells us that God is good. Well, in the middle of life, I have the opportunity to live that out, to decide imperfectly, with struggle, but nonetheless, very real decisions that I make about, is God there? Is he going to do what he has said he's going to do? So, the maturing of our faith, the process of becoming distinctively believing in the way that I live my life, that's really what we're talking about with sanctification. It's not some arbitrary boost of my goodness power. It is, I really believe this, and I am learning what it means to believe this. And so, sanctification is not an extra benefit or obligation which gets tacked on to faith. Sanctification is faith becoming itself. And I think that's a very important thing that James helps us to understand. And then another very important thing that James helps us to understand is the relationship between assurance and sanctification. Some theological traditions have tried to separate assurance of salvation from anything that we see in our own lives. And we can understand why you might want to do this. There are good reasons to try to make this separation. Paul warns us eloquently about the dangers of self-righteousness. And we don't want to become the sort of people who look at our own lives and complacently think, yeah, I've got it together, I am what I ought to be, and God is going to reward me with eternal life. That's like the most serious spiritual danger you can fall into. However, people have mistakenly gotten the idea that the only way we can guard ourselves against that kind of self-righteousness is to absolutely separate the idea that I could assure myself of my salvation from any sort of examination at all of my own life. But James, I think, makes it clear that that can't be done. I would argue essentially that James is arguing for assurance through sanctification. How is it that I come to know that I am a believer? I know that the cross of Christ is adequate to cover all the sins of those who believe, for those who avail themselves of it. But is it possible to be a hypocrite? To be a member of the Christian community, to believe the things of the gospel, and to yet not personally embrace it and believe it for myself? Yes, it is. So how do I know whether I'm one of those kind of people or not? Well, this is what James is talking about. God tests our faith. He takes us through those situations where we ourselves have the opportunity, when something is really on the line, to decide, is this true or not? Is this for me or not? And it is when I make that choice, yes, this is for me, this is what I believe, this is what my life is about, when something is at stake, I walk away from the possibility that that rich guy is going to join this church and start tithing because my values are someplace else. It is when I actually have the opportunity to wrestle with the question of whether I'm going to be merciful and forgive someone when they have done something against me. It's in all those places where the implications of my faith come home to me, and in the process of making those decisions, I see what the faith is about, and I see what it means to me. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. That's the one who is fortunate. Because having been proven, having been tested and found sound, having been found to be indeed a person with a genuine faith, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. But the key in all of this is to understand the nature of the test. Are we being tested for our goodness? Are we being tested for the freedom in our life from sin? No. All of us fail that test. But that's not the nature of the test. The nature of the test is not, are you a sinner or not? I mean, we go through those tests too. And if the question is, are you a sinner? I have passed the test with flying colors. But there's another test. The test is, are you a believer? Do you believe this stuff? Is this for you? Is the promise of the gospel your promise? Do you want what God has offered in the gospel? Well, you're going to find out. Where the rubber meets the road, you're going to find out. Are you going to sin in the midst of that? Yes. But are you going to believe in the midst of that? Quite possibly. Miraculously enough, there are people in this world who hold fast to the promises of God even when the pressure is on. And it is a great blessing to be a person who does so. So, in the end, the connection is a very strong one between trials and sanctification. Because sanctification is really nothing more than becoming a person who has started to understand the implications of being a believer and living those implications out. And it is the very process of testing our faith that brings us to the spot where we grow in that kind of understanding. Okay, well, gosh, I'm sorry. I'm sure that was kind of chaotic, but can I do anything to answer any questions at this point?
Can faith be defined as something God gives us which enables us to believe what is true?
That sounds really good. The only thing I'm hesitating about is if we're going to define faith, faith means believing. Faith is the believing what is true. But yes, I think if we were to back up and ask ultimately what is the source of that, it is the work of the Spirit of God. Faith, so faith is described in a number of different ways with varying kinds of content in the Bible. Faith sometimes can be pictured as believing that Jesus is the Messiah or believing that he rose from the dead. But faith is also described in the Bible in terms of believing that God is going to judge. That's part of our faith. That's part of the set of beliefs we have. It is believing that God's people are wealthy and the rich are poor. You know, that inversion and all of that. And all of that, what I like about what you're saying is sometimes in Christian theology, I think we put too much emphasis on the idea that faith is this act of believing. Because the problem with that is there are many who have committed the act of believing that Jesus is the Messiah. The Judaizers are a good example, who nonetheless had no heart for God. There are reasons you can believe that Jesus is the Messiah besides actually seeing yourself as a sinner in need of the mercy of God. What's significant about the gospel, though, is it is the kind of story that if I have a heart, by the grace of God, that is open to the truth, even the tough truths, like I'm a sinner, and I'm not the center of the universe, and the stuff of this world, which is so attractive, is going to fail me, and I'd better find a substitute, and all of that, that I'm willing to see those truths, and I'm willing to live them out. I'm actually willing to see the implications of them. Yes, what's significant about me is not that I committed an act of belief. What's significant about me is by the grace of God, I have a heart that will respond to truth, including the tough ones. So yeah, I mean, I think you've got the focus in the right place. It is that willingness to believe what is true, especially the truths that we don't like.
Can you compare and contrast the lacking wisdom that you described as the not having a mature faith and the asking without faith and with doubting?
Right. Well, see, picture this situation. James is writing to people who, see, in several places in his letter, he makes an appeal to them that in spite of the fact that many of them have been foolish and worldly and living in such a way that absolutely contradicts what it is they say they believe, nonetheless, there is grace to be found with God. There is redemption and restoration to be found with God. But the question is, what is it that has led to the immaturity and foolishness in the people that James is writing to? Is it just that? Is it immaturity? I mean, experience tells us, I see in my own life, everybody I've ever known, when you become a believer, you don't immediately become mature and understand all the implications of what it is you believe. And I know that I lived for a period of time quite really unaware of the fact that in many ways I was living in the world with a very pagan, worldly mindset that I had not yet really examined in the light of my new set of beliefs. I had these two things kind of running together. And there had to be those kind of points of shock where I bump up against it and go, whoa, wait a minute, what about this? Well, I would say in my own experience, I don't think it's that I was not a believer or that I was a hypocrite in embracing the faith. I was just getting started. I just didn't know what this was all about. And I mean, I'm not pleading just simple ignorance. I mean, it was sinful ignorance. I mean, I was very self-centered and intent on my way of looking at things, and it hadn't gotten through to me yet that I needed to look at things differently. So, if I had heard James' appeal at a certain spot there, I could have seen in what he's saying this message of hope. God generously and without reproach will give wisdom. He is not going to hold it against me that I have been a fool. And that's a very great encouragement. But I still face the question of whether or not I'm going to believe God, whether I'm going to trust Him. If my foolishness, if my worldliness has not just been immaturity, but it is rooted in essence in this refusal to really believe the truths of the gospel, then there really isn't any wisdom to be found for me. When I come to the place of hearing James' exhortation and say, yes, I'm going to call out to God for wisdom, I face the question again. Is God there? Like, it's the question that Hebrews poses, that without faith it is impossible to please God, for the one who comes to Him must believe that He is and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him.
Yeah, another one of those that sends me spinning.
Okay, well, that is the bottom line. What he describes as being double-minded, as being like the wave driven and tossed by the wind, is to be unwilling to settle on the idea that God is there and that He will do what He said He will do. To be struggling with the implications of my faith, even to be struggling with the question of, is this really true? Can I really put my weight on it? That in and of itself is not, I mean, everybody does that, and I think all of James' readers are doing that. But there is a quality that he describes as being double-minded, which is, in essence, I am trying to have it both ways. I will agree that God is there and that He has promises and that He keeps them, but I also believe that you have to look out for number one, and the only way to get what you want in this world is to make sure that you grab it for yourself. And I have these two incompatible sets of beliefs, that God is the one to look to, and I ought to believe that He will do what He promised, and yet I can really only count on myself, and I had better make sure that I get it. That's the kind of double-mindedness, I think, that he's talking about. That's what he models for us later in the book. So believing that He will give wisdom here is to, at this point, I have faced my own folly. I see what's at stake. And what I'm saying is I am willing to put aside the idea that somehow, no, I'm the one who's going to make this all work. I really do believe that God will do what he said he will do. I'm looking to him because that he is the source of life. He is the source of wisdom in this case. That's why I'm looking to him. And with every intention to turn away from the unbelief in my life and believe what it is he is promising, that's how I am turning to him for wisdom. I'm turning to him in simplicity, with a purity of heart. Now, I know. Go ahead.
And an encouragement that you've given me before is that it is more important that you are acting on that. You are not hedging your bets. You are not trying to give yourself a kind of a safety net of there might be another option out there and I don't want to totally burn my bridges over there, or kind of still
right,
thinking
exactly.
That might be a salvation.
Because that's double-mindedness.
And,
that's what he means by that.
That's more double-mindedness than everything is staked on this, and I'm not as confident as I would like to be that everything will be okay. The one is more double-mindedness than I am placing my whole life, I'm risking everything on the fact that God has got to be good, or we're already... I'll just leave that blank. That's not the description of double-mindedness. I mean, it's not great. It's not the goal, obviously, to be experientially without that kind of assurance. But
right.
But walking in a way that is investing your life in that is
that's
an
what
encouragement.
I understand. That is what I understand. At least if we look at James,
struggling to.
That is exactly the reason he's concerned about the people that he's talking to is not because he sat down and had a heart-to-heart talk with many of them and they've said, you know, I have invested my whole life in the gospel. Sometimes, you know, though, I struggle with that question. You know, is this really going to turn out all right? But, you know, I want to believe in God, and I have invested my life in that, and I am counting on him, and I hope that he will help me to gain more confidence as I go along, that he is really on my side. That's not the kind of people that he's writing to. He's writing to people who have said, yes, I believe in Jesus, but meanwhile, excuse me, get out of the way, the rich guy's here. Where everything about the way they have lived, including, he describes them as murdering each other in their attempts to gain worldly possessions. I mean, their desires, their jealousy and selfish ambition is what's driving them. They have no vision of the kingdom of God and what it means for their life. They are living as if everything that this world tells you about looking out for number one is what's true. So that's the challenge of that particular... I know that many people wrestle with that statement of James about believing and not doubting and not being double-minded, because it sounds as if he's precluding that state of things where I'm questioning, where I'm asking the question, you know, is this really true? Where it's the genuine question that I'm working with as I'm pursuing the gospel. I don't think he is precluding that. To waver, the word that he uses there, to be double-minded, is not to ask the legitimate question and to wrestle with the legitimate question, what's going on with this. It is to try to live in two camps, to try to live as if two things were true at the same time. And that really is, I think, what he's getting at. OK. Okay, well, I've run quite a bit over here, so we need to stop.